Welcome to Brown Teacher Reads. This is Mina Malik, a South Asian American high school English teacher. We are continuing with Dava Shastri's Last Day, the current pick for Lily Singh's book club, Lily's Library. This episode, episode 2, will cover the synopsis of the book and the first half of chapter 5. I'm going to be really honest here. When I started this podcast, I thought I would make just one episode per reading assignment, as is mentioned in Lily's Library, but going over this chapter, it became apparent that I had a lot to say. So I'm gonna try to figure out my plan going forward, but I will definitely update you guys once I have a solid plan. Along with this episode, I am so stoked to announce there are some assignments I've created that can be used in real high school English classrooms or that listeners can also do. The assignment that goes along with this episode is a personal essay about the moment when you first realized what the color of your skin was, and a companion artwork piece to that essay to help you express your story in another medium. If you end up doing the assignments, please send them into me at brownteacherreads@gmail.com. I would love to see these. And with no further ado, here's the rest of the episode. I decided to take an actual look at the book synopsis, and it turns out this is not a murder mystery, so thank God I can stop reading it through that lens, and also thank God it is not that, because I do not really have the stomach for thrillers and murders and things like that. So here's chapter 5, which is titled Force of Nature, and I'm just gonna start with a quick summary of what happens in this chapter and what the purpose of this chapter is in the book in my eyes. So Sita sends out a statement about their mother's death at the beginning of the chapter. And then we have a lot of different point of view shifts happening in the different sections of the chapter. So we start out with Arvi's perspective, and perhaps it's Arvi and Kali at the same time. I couldn't quite decipher that. And then we go to Sandy, and then we go to Sita, and then we go to Enzo, one of the grandchildren. Mostly this chapter, what it does is that it just goes through the siblings one at a time, and it talks about their concerns in terms of what's going on with their mom and her end-of-life situation. And so all of the major interests and motivations and worries and fears and stuff of each of the siblings and what they're going through is being exposed here. So in the first section, we're talking about Arvi and Kali here for the most part, and this section seems like it's mostly from Arvi's perspective. And it turns out that Arvi and Kali have a little bit of a bonding experience, and they do some processing of their emotions and thoughts together, which is nice. One of the things early on in the chapter that's mentioned is that it says, the siblings had made a beeline to the liquor cabinet to fix themselves vodka sodas. And honestly, as a Muslim, I'm just personally disgusted by the habit of people drinking to numb themselves from reality. I think that people do not consider alcohol rightfully as the type of medicating drug type substance it is. And for those of you who don't know, Islam has a very strong stance against alcohol. So this is something that I don't relate to at all. It's something that I find pretty abhorrent, actually. So Arvi does say something which makes me think that I might know what his major concern or interest is at this time. And he says, because even when she's dying, she can't stop treating us like heirs to her throne. She acts like the Shastri name is a sacred birthright that gives her the right to dictate our lives just because she got lucky and made a lot of money. And I find this pretty interesting that Arvi's saying this. One, because it's an echo to that idea of Dava being a queen and, you know, her children inheriting the throne, a type of a sacred birthright. And I think what Arvi's huge problem is that he just feels like a lot of pressure. And I think he is the oldest child, so it might make sense that he feels a lot of undue pressure. I'm just wondering, like, especially since the way he is seen within the family during the argument that they had at the dinner table, like how he was kind of really thrown under the bus. And apparently he only works 3 days a month for his mom, but she basically, you know, gives him a lot of money to basically fund his life. So I'm just wondering, like, what led up to this problem. And if we look at another thing that's been bothering Arvi is when he was scolded at the dinner table in front of everyone. And it says in the book that he's really annoyed that Dava has invoked his birth name, Arvind.
This name was supposed to be a synthesis of his parents, a tribute to his father, Arvid, while also a reflection of his mother's Indian heritage. But everyone, including his late father, referred to him as Arvi. And I find this interesting because maybe this is where a lot of the pressure kind of starts, where he feels like he has to really live up to both of his parents' names, literally. I also think that it's interesting that the multicultural couple is making a little multicultural mix in terms of his name, but I'm pretty sure Arvind is like an actual real name because that is the name of the gross creepy uncle in Never Have I Ever. And I also feel like it's interesting that Dava and Arvid as a couple decided to kind of mix their identities into the first child's name. And literally, that's kind of pretty much what having a child biologically entails. So I'm down for the name choice. And he does mention that, and when she called him Arvind at dinner that night, she said it as if placing it in quotation marks, as if he wasn't worthy of it. And so I feel like maybe he is feeling really self-conscious about, what does my mom really think about me? Did I really live up to her expectations and everything? Especially since he knows that she's on her way out. Next, we move on to Kali's interests. And mostly, I think what she's doing is she is just processing all the hurt feelings that she's experiencing. So she says, "We're not going to lose her in a few months. We're going to lose her in a day or two. To know it's coming and she planned it is weird. And that doesn't even include the surrealness of her pretending to the world she's dead." And so I feel like really the kind of shocking thing for Kali is that her mom did plan to pass away, but she also did it like completely without involving her kids. And she has barely given them any time to cope with or understand what's been going on. And honestly, like, Dava didn't have to have this plan. And actually, I think this plan is not a good idea. And there's a few reasons why I think her plan was really short-sighted. One, she could have told her children as soon as she found out about her diagnosis to give them a little bit more time to cope with the news. And at this point, if she had given them a little bit of a heads up and even told them that she wanted to plan her end of life scenario in a really specific way, then hopefully the children could have come to her and dealt with any outstanding issues or any type of quarrels or beef they had with each other. They could have had an opportunity to heal and move on in a really good way, especially because obviously once you die, you don't really move on in your relationship with someone actively in like a two-way street scenario. And Dava didn't only miss out on an opportunity to connect with her children and family in a meaningful way, which I personally think she's really fearful of for some reason, but she also has this obsession, right, with what people think about her, which is what Kali does mention at the end, the surrealness of her pretending to the world she's dead. And we really know this is just because she wants to know how she is remembered. And honestly, if she only wants good press about herself, right, there are two things she could have done. Very practical. She could have hired a ghostwriter and she could have dictated her memoir to this person, and there could have been an autobiographical type of book. She could have even done full-on interviews. Like, it could have been great. She could have recorded the audio version of it in her own audiobook, and she could have really dictated and created the story that she wanted everyone to know about her, right? Because there's no mention that she has a autobiographical type of a text out about her own life. The other thing is, I was just thinking, is that she could have had this like crazy lit party where basically it was just all about her, right? And I mean, she's kind of a really like high-flying billionaire celebrity type of a person. So would this really be that unexpected? Not really. But, you know, kind of like how at weddings, like people give like heartfelt emotional speeches about you and they give you toasts and stuff. Like, she could have had like a send-off party where she invited all the people that she knew would say good things about her, and she could have told them, like, "I want each of you to prepare a 4-minute toast on me and write it down even." You know what I mean? Like, if she wanted to hear people sing her praises, she could have easily arranged for that. And she could have even done it in a creative way. And her children could have known, like, okay, next weekend my mom's dying. And then perhaps maybe Dava would have even had enough closure to just die without pretending to die and then needing to see what people say about her. And this is another interesting thing that makes me think about Dava and who she is as a person. So there's somebody in my husband's family who reminds me a lot of Dava.
just insofar as she is like a matriarch. She was a trailblazing professional in her field, the first female OBGYN practicing in Central Florida. And, you know, this was a big deal, especially as an immigrant from Pakistan. And I think she started working in the States in the 80s, I believe. I'm sure the climate was challenging in many ways and probably in more ways than it is now. So when I think about my husband's aunt versus Dava, I think about what they prioritize and what is in focus right now, you know, towards the end of their lives, right? So like my husband's aunt is also in her 70s. And so I just think like whenever I talk to my husband's aunt, she doesn't care what people think about her, which I feel like is a really freeing type of superpower, I would say, to have. And really what she just is worried about, what it seems like to me from like very deep conversations she's had with us, I really feel like she's at the point in her life where she's like, yeah, I just want to be good with God and I want God to think good things about me, right? And that's her focus. Her focus is what comes next in terms of in the next life, which Muslims believe in, right? But when I think about Dava, I just feel so bad for her because she's replaced what does God think about me with what do people think about me and say about me? What does the world think and say about me? It gives me a lot of pause because, you know, if you think about if she had changed her mind to say, what does God think about me, right? God in the Islamic tradition knows every little thing, all knowing, all seeing, all hearing, the ultimate, supremely powerful divine power, right? And I just think that if Dava had switched her focus on what does God think about me, then she could have felt perhaps a little bit more at ease, unless she's really doing some shady, weird things in her life, then she probably would be worried, which would make sense, right? But getting back to what the crux of what I'm saying is that, you know, he would be a quote unquote objective type of viewer, or at least if you believe in God, right? And you would believe in the structure of whatever rules and lifestyles. As a Muslim, I'm speaking about this, obviously. And so you would kind of ascribe yourself to those things. So you're like, I know exactly the rubric I'm being graded on is, right? But then when you think about like other people in the world who are seeing you, like everyone has their own subjective views of you. People know a little bit of information about you one day or another day, but they don't know your whole life trajectory. They don't know every little detail about you. And so I'm just like, this is a lot of obsession about what people think about you, but like, what do you think about you? Or can we just focus on what's the most important thing to you? What does your family think about you even? Like, that would be a way better microcosm of people to focus on, right? Rather than the whole freaking world. And the last thing I want to say about obituaries and this idea of collecting obituaries, which I've kind of mentioned, like, I would like to read all the obituaries and different publications about her all together at the end of the book. There are multiple verses in the Quran which talk about people reading their book of deeds. And so there's this repeated idea of people being handed their books in their right hand if they're going to heaven, and people being handed books in their left hand if they're going to hell. And then there's also this idea of when people like get their account, right? They read it and they're like good people going to heaven. They're like, whoa, look at my book. Like, everyone read my book. And they're like freaking out and they're like just totally hyped. And they're like, yeah, look at all the good things it says about me in here. And like, it's so funny because as a practicing Muslim who really believes in Islam, like, I feel like this idea of Dava wanting to know good things that she has done in her life in this culmination in a record, that doesn't sound far-fetched to me at all. That sounds like pretty natural, like a pretty natural human instinct. The verse I specifically just mentioned is from Surat Al-Haqqa, verse 19, and Al-Haqqa is translated as the reality. So it says, A'udhu billahi minashaytanir rajim. فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوتِيَ كِتَابَهُ بِيَمِينِهِ. And as for those given their records in their right hand, فَيَقُولُ هَا أُمُقْرَأُ كِتَابِيَ. They will cry happily, here, everyone, read my record. And to contrast that, later in the same chapter of the Quran, in verse 25, the people given their record in the left hand will say, فَيَقُولُ يَا لَيْتَنِي لَمْ أُوتَ كِتَابِيَ. And then they cry bitterly, I wish I had not been given my record. I really feel like Dava made this choice by sticking around. Her curiosity really got the best of her. And honestly, curiosity kills the cat, perhaps. Maybe a really bad
pun to use here at this time. And another part of the Quran that this reminds me of is Surat al-Kahf, verse 49. Al-Kahf is translated as the cave, and it's a surah that Muslims are encouraged to read every Friday, and I often listen to it every Friday because sitting down to read the Quran for me is also difficult and cumbersome, so a lot of the times I'll just listen. But this is specifically in the context of people who are the left-hand receivers, and they say, وَيَقُولُونَ يَا وَيْلَتَنَا مَا لِهَا هذا الكتاب لا يغادر صغيرة ولا كبيرة إلا أحصاها ووجدوا ما عملوا حاضرا ولا يظلم ربك أحدا. And this really goes back to my ideas about God looking at your record. And I'm gonna translate it. And it says, they will cry woe to us because they were in the wrong. What kind of record is this? Or what kind of book is this that it does not leave any sin, small or large, unlisted? They will find whatever they did present before them, and your Lord will never wrong anyone. But it's really interesting, this mali hadhal kitab doesn't leave, like, what is it with this book? And like, this mali is something that is like very emphatic. And I remember when I was first learning classical Arabic, I was just learning these little basic grammar things, and I used to read this every Friday. So then I like took it to my teacher. His name's Jamil Bisada. He's a legit scholar now, and I'm just personally so happy for him that he was able to finish his education and give back to people in a meaningful way, because, you know, he was just teaching a lowly basic grammar Arabic class to a few people at the masjid or mosque that I used to go to. And I, through my very desperate insistence, convinced him to come to my college, UCI, to teach Arabic classes too. And they really fizzled out because not many people were coming to them. I mean, I don't know where he lived, but, you know, the poor guy used to drive all the way to Irvine and then park. And you know what a nightmare can be parking at college campuses. Anyways, this verse in particular is really close to my heart, but the grammatical strangeness of this in the Arabic language just really goes to show like the incredible amount of shock at how like every little thing I did is recorded here, whether it was big or whether it was small. Nothing has been excluded and everything is here. As a person who believes in Islam and in this context, I feel like even if I was a right-handed person, which I really pray that I am, I feel like I would also be like, whoa, what's up with this book, dude? This has captured every little thing, but in like a good way, not in a like, oh my God, type of a way, like kind of when you see a test or like an essay. And you know, when I used to get essays, there used to be some like little squiggly underlines, which was like, hey, like that was legit, good job. And then there used to be like red marks and question marks, like word choice or grammar issues, you know. But I'm just like, yeah, like give me my essay and just like make smiley faces all over it, you know. Like I feel like this is what a book in your right hand would be like. And I mean, I understand that Davo kind of wants that, because I want that too, just in a really different context and with a really different presumption about what is the most important thing in my world and in my life. And I can say this right now, but I really pray for sincerity in terms of keeping my perspective really close to my heart and true in my life. Whoa, I just hardcore nerded out over this book and some verses from the Quran that I know. That was legit and dope, at least for me. And hey, this is the benefit of running my own literature circle, isn't it? Anyways, getting back to Kali, I do understand how she is just so baffled by Dava's very eccentric and really unheard of plan to pretend she's dead so she can hear everything that people are saying about her. Another thing that is really bothering Kali right now is she feels kind of betrayed by Rev for not letting her know that he is expecting to be a father. She says, "How come he didn't tell me before now?" She drummed her fingers over her lips as if she had said too much. I think it can be really devastating to siblings to navigate life once they are not all together and once they are not the most important person to each other anymore. I have two sisters and a brother. My brother is a bit younger than me and he's still in college, but both of my sisters are around my age and they're both married, and it's a new stage of the type of a relationship you have with your siblings. But honestly, I wish I could go back to the time where we like all live together and we're just like having fun. But at the same time, like their husbands do bring an interesting mix into our family.
It does mention that Rev and Kali's bond
is a twin-like bond. I think Kali is just looking for some type of reassurance that she's not losing her most meaningful family connections all in one day, because her mom's saying she's dying and then her father has already passed away. And then the sibling she's the closest with, Rev, he is like moving on in his own family, right? Sita's been a mom for a while and, you know, I'm sure Sita's involvement with Kali has really fallen off since her own immediate new nuclear family has probably taken the majority of her time and attention. And Arvi just seems like a bit of a jerk that she never really connected with or really cared too much about and had a good relationship with. And it's interesting that Arvi does put his arm around her narrow shoulders, something he had not done since they were kids. And it just kind of shows like how much, you know, he's really drifted apart from his own sibling and he wasn't used to being tactile with his siblings or having them pour out their feelings to him. Which is, you know, an interesting thing to say about Arvi. And if we continue to talk about Arvi when he's processing Kali's emotions in regard to Rev's unexpected pregnancy, Arvi does mention he could not help taking a sour delight in their estrangement. Their meaning Rev and Kali's. And I'm like, yo, Arvi, you need to watch that little bit of emotion in you. In Islam, there is something called diseases of the heart, and there are ways you can try to work to purify yourself of those diseases and like clean your heart. Jealousy is one of those. Arvi, you're having some ugly feelings here, this sour delight, because you are jealous that you don't have a bond like this with any one of your siblings or all of them. Arvi, you need to try a little bit harder and keep on this trajectory, and maybe you'll get there, hopefully. Maybe this is a turning point for you when your mom is deciding to end her life. Maybe you can like step up and be the person you want to be instead of worrying about what everyone else thinks about you, because I really think he does want to be better. He just doesn't know how to be better. And then Kali does also mention the other thing that's really bothering her is that she doesn't have anyone in her corner, meaning the couple that she is in a poly relationship with is not there and has not been invited for Christmas. Arvi makes a judgment on her, saying Kali's dating history was like her artwork, colorful and baffling. And this little information about Kali is intriguing to me. You know, she's kind of painted as this like artist and, you know, what those kind of tropes are generally in books and films and stuff like that. And then close to the end of the section, Arvi says, welcome to the rage club. And so I suppose he is describing his situation and Kali's situation as they're both just really, really mad at what's happening and what their mom is putting them through. The second section of this chapter, chapter 5, is from Sandy's point of view, and she's really just concerned about the baby's future, where she fits into this family. And then we also see some of Rev grappling with the medical care situation with his mom in terms of her cancer and her end-of-life plan. And I feel like we also see him trying to connect himself to his family's past, the past that existed before he was born. Probably he wants to just feel more connected to his mom. Heading into the text, I want to focus on the space itself, which is the den, which is the one part of the home which is a big deviation from the Swiss model it was built after. And so from the book it says, spending time in the den was like traveling to an era he had heard so much about, the brief period where his mother had become wealthy overnight after selling Medici artists, but not yet a billionaire. A time when his parents slow danced in the kitchen and folded laundry together while watching television. I think it's interesting that this one part of the house is preserved in this way. I think it's probably really special to everyone in the family. And I also wonder if Dava likes to revisit this space. Because if she didn't like to revisit this era in her life, I don't know why she would keep a whole room in the house like this. And since it was very particularly built in that way, I have a feeling like she did it on purpose. But at the same time, I'm just wondering what her thoughts are about her past. Does she come down into this room? How often does she come down here to feel close to Arvid? Or what is her deal with that? And this reminds me of a small incident from the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in which one of his wives and him got married basically off the side of the road between Mecca and Medina. And this is in the outskirts of Mecca.
she outlived her husband. Her name was Maymuna. There's just this really like romantic notion of her when she would really miss him. Like she would go and spend a lot of time in that space, like literally on the side of the road, on the outskirts of the city. And she would just remember him there. And then before she passed away, she asked if she could be buried at the spot she was married. And I just felt like that was like so romantic and so beautiful and so just heartbreaking of a story. And I actually got to visit that spot and I actually got to see her grave. When I went to Mecca and Medina to make Hajj, like, and I think I performed Hajj in 2017, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, I wonder if Dava does something similar here where she kind of haunts this place as a way to remember him. Also, if I think about the way she would remember him is also probably when she felt like her family was really whole and to some degree highly prioritized in her life. A lot of people say women can't have it all. And people also say a woman's life is a life of seasons where you can't do everything at once, but you can do a few things at one time. And then you just choose what you want to do right now and what you want to do later and what you're not going to do. And I honestly, as a woman myself who has a family, I really don't know what to think or say about that. But I do personally believe that you cannot have it all, particularly as a woman, but probably for anyone. But really for a woman, yeah, I really don't think you can have it all for sure. So I'm just wondering if Dava liked her life before she really blew up into this big person where she did have the time to slow dance in the kitchen and fold her own laundry with her husband while they watched TV. Because you can imagine that Dava, once she got really, really wealthy, never folded her own laundry or probably rarely slow danced in the kitchen with her own husband. Because I do think that having a domestic life with your family does allow for moments of connection and all these little things while you're cleaning out the garage together, while you're cutting vegetables for dinner, make fun and make memories in those really otherwise meaningless and unimportant tasks, right? A lot of the times when we think about people that we really love and we're close to and perhaps don't live near us or are not alive anymore, we often think about the small things they used to do for us all the time. When I think about my mom, thankfully she's living and I really hope she has a nice, long, healthy life. When I think about my mom, I just think about like how I miss so much like coming home and being met with this aroma of whatever food she has cooked that day. And it's so funny because one of my Taiwanese friends, Annie from high school, she mentioned to me one of the times she was coming over to my house when she like opened the front door and she was like, "Mina, your house always smells like food." And that's actually how I even started noticing that. Like my friend just noting, "Your house always smells like fresh home-cooked food," which my mom was totally into. And that's like one of my mom's love languages is like cooking for people. So I really miss that. And I just wonder like, what will Dava's children miss about her? I don't know. I would love the book to tell me. Moving on, we do hear a little bit about how Sandy and Rev met, how Sandy basically was his real estate agent, and then they ended up kind of getting together. But it is interesting to me that Sandy mentions she tried not to fall for Rev after realizing he was an unemployed trust funder who was also 5 years her junior. Oh, Miss Sandy White Lady, this feels like a little bit of a rishta situation. For people who are not desi, rishta is like, you know, that Indian matchmaking type of thing on Netflix. And she did some quick math on his basic biographical information, like on his bio data, perhaps. And she was like, he's 5 years younger than me. And he doesn't have a job, but he's a rich, spoiled brat of a kid. Gotcha. Not interested. However, she does end up falling for him. Well, when Rev ends up coming back into the den after visiting the doctor, he does mention that Dr. Windsor seemed to have an inkling his mother had already declared herself dead, which means she probably has some type of phone or something like that with her. And Rev does say, which is also my thought, "I wonder what Amma is giving her in exchange for her services. A hospital wing or an entire hospital?" Because he's just like, "Yeah, my mom can buy this stuff, dude." It just seems like an interesting thing to keep involving more and more people in this plan because Dava is risking for information to be leaked. But, you know, money does buy a lot of people silence. So now we're kind of moving more into Sandy's understanding and concerns about the family and how her and her hopefully to be baby will fit in. She's looking at this picture and she's looking at all the men in the family. And she says, although Colin, diminutive compared to the other men, was also cute in a vaguely exotic way. I'm like, oh, cringe, cringe, cringe. What can I say other than white people? I feel like Sandy's a little bit aware that she just said something cringy because her face turned bright pink and she says, what is Colin's heritage? Like asking, what is he? And how many brown people listening to this hate that question? What are you? Where are you from? No, no, no. What are you really? Ugh. Seriously, dude. Well, it turns out that he is half Brazilian and half Japanese. It turns out that Vincent is Swedish, just like Arvid. And then as we move along looking at the picture, and Sandy starts to wonder about what her kid might look like. So she says, Sita's kids and Arvi's kids, they look the same. I mean, like skin color. She blushed even harder. Like, I can't tell the twins are of Japanese descent at all. And the girls don't look very Indian. And then she says, I sound so white, don't I? And Rev, he chuckled. I get what you're driving at. Yeah, they all look pretty weedish. And then he goes on to say, in matrimonial ads, it's what you call yourselves when you don't want to admit you're dark. But he does say it's a skin color that's the happy medium between fair and brown. We're in the middle, he says. I feel like if Sandy is just wondering this, like what her baby will look like in a very innocent way, but then I have a feeling like she's also perhaps worried about if the baby will look like it's part of the family. And I know a couple who is, the man is Desi. I'm pretty sure he's either Hyderabadi or Pakistani, but I'm leaning towards Hydro here. And the woman is a white convert to Islam. And so I remember there was like something like really crazy that happened, like, you know, with Muslims, and then Muslims were scared for a few days. It was probably around Donald Trump time. And she had just shared a picture of her son and daughter on Facebook. And I just saw it when I was like having this in the back of my head. And then I just looked at her kids and I was like, they don't look white to me. It must be so hard to imagine that your kids do not have the same protection as you just because they don't look white to the rest of the world. And so that was something that I thought was like a really interesting thing that anyone in her situation, whether it's a white mom or dad or any type of family member who has to deal with the reality of wanting to protect their children but also not being able to because they can't pass on the one impervious shield of protection, which is literally just appearing white, your whiteness. I just feel like Rev is kind of quieting her a little bit and not in a good way when he says, don't get hung up on the color thing so much, Sandy. And then he's like kind of initiating her into the family a bit by just explaining the whole rainbow family, heavy on the beige. And I really don't think that Rev understands the color thing because he is a person of color, but he's also mixed. So he's half white, but then he also is in a position of incredible privilege and authority just based on his parents' wealth and his mom's social status and his freedom in life. He was also a model, so he probably believes himself to be visually alluring and attractive, right? In a vaguely exotic way, you know, enough to make money off of it. I just don't feel like he's really getting it because I think, as I mentioned, as a white parent having a child of color, I think that that must be really, really unnerving, especially like I think about my husband's boss who is German, but he's married to a Black British woman and his kids look Black. And I'm just wondering how worried his father must be for his child's safety, especially in light of all of the police brutality against innocent Black men and boys. And I'm just thinking like, yeah, that must be really scary for my husband's boss. Maybe hopefully Sandy is somewhat aware of, you know, all of the social justice issues and ills at her time, which I'm assuming are pretty much the same as our current time, even though this book is set in 2044. And yeah, I would just hope that Sandy is really just worried about her child's well-being and that it's not any more problematic than that. The other interesting thing that's going on with Sandy is that she says, will she set up a trust for our baby, even though she technically can't since she's
already dead, right, on paper.
Sandy, you're acting like a little bit of a gold digger here, aren't you? Or are you not? Am I wrong? I don't know. Give me your feedback. Tell me if I'm reading and judging Sandy totally wrong. But I just feel like this is a very shallow, materialistic concern that Sandy is having that could give us some more information about why she's worried if her unborn child will fit in the family look and feel or not. And I think like fitting into the family, buying into this family means you get a lot of wealth, right? Sandy would be taken care of. Her baby would be taken care of. Rev, he has like more than $6 million left in his trust fund. And I'm just like, you know, Rev, if you played it right, you could provide a comfortable life for your family, however large it is, right? You already have the startup capital to make good investments. Even though Rev has all this access to money, I'm just wondering why Sandy is still plowing on about the baby's trust fund. And even though Sandy comes from a really humble financial background, I'm just confused why she doesn't think that Rev's money that he already has is enough for them. Sandy, why do you keep going for more and more? I don't get it. As soon as we find a little bit of wealth, we just want more and more, and we just want to keep piling on all the luxury and all the materialistic things. And this belief, once again, comes from my belief in Islam. And there's a chapter in the Quran which is called Surat At-Takathur, and it starts out, A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim, Al-Hakum At-Takathur. Hatta zurtumul maqabir. And the translation of this is basically this rush and competition to get more and more piece of the pie diverts you from your focus on God, which is what it should be, on Allah. And then it says that this desire to just keep piling and amassing more and more wealth lasts until you end up in your grave. And yeah, I feel like that could be really true for most people because wealth is really alluring, and don't we just always want more? Definitely, this is true for my scrapbook paper collection, and I will say I do have a problem with scrapbook paper collecting. I do use it, but I do have way more than I need. And this would be a great segue to talk about what Dava thinks about her wealth, and she says, to me, it is a responsibility and a promise, a responsibility to leave this world better than I left it, and a promise that generations of Shastris will always be taken care of so they can focus on helping others who are less fortunate. I feel like it's interesting that she does have this philanthropic stint towards her idea of wealth, and I also think that it's interesting that she does have this more personal motivation to make sure that her children and grandchildren, and I'm assuming all other Shastri generations, will be taken care of. And I feel like it's interesting that she gives a reason for that, so they can focus on helping others who are less fortunate. With great power comes great responsibility, but it's like with great wealth comes responsibility and a promise. You know what I mean? So it kind of reinforces this idea that billionaires existing in the world, I definitely do not think that's right. I do not think that's ethical. And honestly, as a person who believes that everyone should pay their fair share in taxes, I'm just wondering how sometimes me and my husband, who make close to no money compared to a millionaire or a billionaire, how we could potentially end up paying more money in taxes than a person with millions or billions of dollars, that makes zero sense to me. I am all for Bernie Sanders being in charge of rewriting the way that taxes are done in this country. I am all for big companies being broken up and paying their fair share of taxes, freaking Amazon. Ugh, it's just so frustrating to me. And although millionaires and billionaires do have like all these big foundations and big charitable donations, why don't we like talk to a lot of people who know what might be good for everyone? And why don't we let ourselves decide what we spend millions of dollars researching and improving? You know what I mean? Like, I am a little bit of a believer in government, even though one of my experiences with government, the US government, this democracy, quote unquote, is pretty dysfunctional. The way that our votes are counted are not even real. Like, my vote does not equal one vote based on the way that votes are tallied and divvied up between counties and states and everything. So terrible. So terrible. As a side note, Hussam Minhaj does mention in The Patriot Act, his show on Netflix, which I really want to come back. And it was really sad that it went away because I was like, no, Brown John Oliver. But he does talk about some type of voting where you basically vote for runners up in some countries. And I'm just like, yeah, we can do that. That would sound like a great idea. Patriot Act is also available on YouTube, I believe, from my recollection. So thankfully, there's not a paywall in order to access that information. Also, I was an Islamic school teacher, which I really never want to do again in my life, while the Patriot Act was running and coming out and everything. And there were so many things I wanted to show my children, show my students, but I just couldn't because it was an Islamic school. And like, if there was any dirty language, I would get in so much trouble. I would really like for some of these bigger people who make content that is very important and they have a little bit of a cool vibe to them, could you please just make it a little bit cleaner so that it's more friendly to show to younger students without the teacher getting their head chopped off? Because, you know, honestly, in a public school, I don't know if I could show some of his episodes from the Patriot Act either, because I think he does cuss quite a bit. So just a note. If we get back to the picture, there's this really interesting thing that Sandy kind of lets slip here at the very end as they're leaving the den. She says, "I wonder if she ever feels alone." "Your mother," she said sadly, "she's the only one who has brown skin. I wonder how that makes her feel." I feel like this is the most unfiltered thing she's said so far about Lava, and I think it's also a very, very apt observation, probably that Rev has never even thought about before, because, you know, that's just his mom. It's not that complicated. You know what I mean? It's interesting to me that she says this, because this is a thought that did cross my mind before, where I wondered in episode one about, does Dava feel this really overwhelming pressure as a celebrity type person for being a person of color? And I guess I didn't realize that that kind of pressure might also be felt personally within your own family. And I'm not saying what Sandy is true, whether or not his mom does feel any type of a way because of her skin color, but it's just an interesting idea being brought up. And I really love that the book is just complicating this so much. And to me, I would really feel like in the classroom, this would be a great time to talk about colorism, to talk about how the history of colorism comes from colonialism, and this could be an interesting opportunity to let people talk about their own personal lives, their own personal experiences with their skin color. And there is this idea, I heard about it in a class that I took in graduate school called Multicultural Counseling. The idea is a racial identity model. And the gist of the idea is that at some point in time, people realize what the color of their skin is. If you are black or brown, you tend to realize this very early on in childhood, and a lot of the times white people do not realize this at all or much later in their lives. And I actually ended up writing a paper about this moment for myself while I was in this class. I'm gonna wrap up the episode here. I did manage to get through Arvi and Kali's perspectives as well as Sandy's perspective in the first half of chapter 5. Before I close out this podcast episode, I'm going to quickly talk about the assignment that I created that could go along very well with this chapter and honestly the rest of this book. This assignment could go along with any book, and as a matter of fact, this assignment could just be something that you use in an English class with no books in mind, or in history class, or other classes in the soft sciences. So the assignment is called Racial Identity Autobiography Personal Essay and Artwork Project, When I First Realized the Color of My Skin. The first half of this assignment is a personal essay. Write a personal essay detailing the moment when you first realized the color of your skin. Requirements for this essay are that it is between 450 and 550 words long in MLA format, that it provides meaningful details from your memory or experience, which appeal to the five senses, and that it also has a clear organizational structure. I have provided a sample called A Brown Muslim that I wrote, and you can check that out on my website, brownteacherreads.com, along with the document that has the assignment written down, and I will also read it for you guys in another episode. The accompanying artwork project is as follows. Create a piece of art to represent this moment in your life, thinking about what it meant to you then and or today. You control the narrative about your skin color and what it means to you, no matter what your first experience realizing what the color of your skin was. The artwork can be on any medium and will be displayed gallery style in class. And I have a note that you must fill out a proposal form. Just for talking about parameters for the assignment, I would assign this after I've seen the essay and graded it in class. class. And just a note about the artwork in my mind is a way for students who had a very traumatic experience of realizing what the color of their skin was, is just for them to be able to reclaim that and create the narrative that they want to create, right? If there's one thing we learn about in Dava Shastri's last day, is that Dava did have the potential to control and create the narrative that she wanted the world to believe about her. And for the students in my class, I wouldn't want them to do this in like a really manipulative or shady way like Dava might have done, but I just want to give them a chance to rise above that moment and to own it in a beautiful way and to take the control back into their own hands and say like, hey, yeah, this happened to me, and either deal with that if they are up to it, or deal with where they are now and how their understanding of themselves has grown and evolved. And I think this would be a good set of options to allow students to figure out what they're comfortable with in terms of sharing and not sharing with their peers. If you want to do this assignment, if you're a podcast listener, please, please, please send what you made to me at brownteacherreads@gmail.com. I would love to look at this. If I like what I see, I'll hit you up and ask you if it's okay if I feature this on my website and my other social media channels, or even read out your essay in a future podcast. This is the circle part of the podcast where I would love for other voices to join into this circle, because this project is much, much bigger than me. Please check out this assignment at brownteacherreads.com. And I hope if you have teacher friends, if you are not a teacher yourself, please share this with your teacher friends if they teach a soft science, because I am sure this would be a very meaningful experience in any classroom.
And students need to know, not only students, every person needs to know that there is a hierarchical structure in this world based on the arbitrary factor of how much melanin you have in your skin and what that means. It doesn't only have to be on the black and brown kids, seriously, because a lot of the times white is invisible. God.
Don't forget to check out my website, brownteacherreads.com, for the assignment that goes along with this chapter, as well as links to things I've mentioned, like the Patriot Act episode. Thanks for listening to this episode of Brown Teacher Reads. This is Mina Malik, a Pakistani Muslim American high school English teacher, and I'll catch you next time. Special thanks to my husband and sisters and brother for all the support that they've given me in getting this podcast off the ground. Love you guys.